The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Apparently everybody in my circle did not know what yesterday was. My parents are in from out of town. My lovely wife. I've got some very informed friends. You are the smartest audience in all of radio. I didn't get a single call from any of you. Shame on each of you tuning in this morning. Do you know what yesterday was? I hope you all feel a little sense of shame for not knowing. I do. Yesterday was the six-month anniversary, ladies and gentlemen, of the Capitol Hill insurgency, the domestic terror foisted upon the Republic by Trump voters. How can you not remember that? Boy, you talk about trying to make a thing a thing. I was just in my office a minute ago, and prepping for the show here. I don't even know why, but I have MSNBC on. Now, I monitor all three cables every day. I monitor CNN, MSNBC, and Fox here in my studio. In the office, I typically have Fox on. I've just got the one monitor in my office. For some reason, I don't know why. Maybe for my entertainment, I'm not sure. MSNBC is on. Or some lefty sneaking in there when I'm out of the office. I don't know which, but it's on. And I see that there's this doctor on talking with the anchor. They call their show way too early. That's about the only thing MSNBC's gotten right. It is an extraordinarily painfully early hour. But to be peddling the politics they peddle is, yes, it's way too. It's always too early for that. But anyway, I don't know who the lady is that anchors this early morning nonsense that they peddle on. But they got a doctor on. And the first thing is, I see the caption is what gets me. I turn up the volume because I missed what they were talking about. The caption said, Biden still refuses to mandate vaccines. Like, they're mad. I could tell that they were having a discussion. This doctor and this anchor from MSNBC were irritated that the doctor, that Biden would not enforce and demand, even though he has pledged yesterday he's going to go door to door. You have your vaccine yet? Apparently they're going to send out, that's going to work out well. Going to send government agents door to door to ask everybody in the house been vaccinated. Papers, please. Not at all creepy. Okay, but anyway, so they're lamenting Biden's lack of embrace of forcing us all to get vaccines. But then it pivots to, you can't make it up. These people, it's one thing after another. Do you know that this doctor has written a piece in The Hill, something to the effect that infrastructure continues to remain a major, major threat to public health? Infrastructure. I mean, they can politicize anything. They can twist anything to suit their narrative. This doctor had written a piece about how bridges and roads, and get this, they used the collapse of the building in Surfside, Florida, as a threat to public health. Never mind that bodies were falling in major metropolitan cities over the span of 72 hours at a alarmingly rapid pace. I don't even know. I saw McSwain tweeted out numbers for Philadelphia in just 48 hours. It was some disgusting, staggering number of deaths and shootings in just Philadelphia alone. I love that they have a doctor on to talk about the public health crisis of failing infrastructure and a building collapse that, yes, tragically, appears to have probably killed well over 100 people by the time they recovered all the bodies. But to suggest that infrastructure and a collapsed building in Florida is a greater threat or this looming threat, and we've got to pour trillions of dollars into infrastructure, taxpayer money into, quote, infrastructure to save lives. Hilarious. So I turn it up for a little giggle. All right? It's my warm-up to the show. Puts me in a good mood. I have a, you know, I point and laugh at the idiots. But then she signs off just before Morning Joe begins, just before I got to come in here to the studio to start the show. And here's how she signs off. And on a personal note, I just want to say that yesterday marked the 6th anniversary. I'm kind of half listening, and I'm getting the paper, my stuff ready to go, and I kind of look. I'm like, the 6th anniversary of what? Like, why is she getting all melancholy? The 6th anniversary of the Capitol Hill riots. What? They're commemorating 6-month sessions now? Like, they're marking on the calendar every 6th. Oh, it's another month that's gone by. And she said, it's particularly poignant to me because I was there, and I want to thank the Capitol Hill police for protecting those of us who were there doing our jobs then. And I want you to know that even though 6 months has gone by, we have not forgotten you, you heroes. What in the world did I just watch? I said to myself. So I had to start the show with an admonishment that we let a very somber day go by yesterday, the 6-month anniversary of the insurrection.
It's like celebrating anniversaries when you're first dating, you know, like when I was a teenager. Oh, it's our 5-month. It's our 6-month. So now I'll remember next month to commemorate the 7th.
Well, that's right. Or little Eddie. Your new little baby, you know, when he's 2, instead of calling him 2, he's 24 months. It's that same kind of thing. Women who won't let that go and continue to call the baby by months, even though you're now years into the child's life, they still refer to it in terms of months because they like hanging on to the notion that it's new and fresh. So this really, now I've just thought about it that way, that's true. For the American left, that capital insurrection, that's their infant, that's their little baby they're nurturing fresh from the womb, that's their political scandal. They're going to try to whip that thing like Seabiscuit to the finish line of 2022. So they're going to be, they probably will, they're going to, it's been 23 months, this is the 23 month anniversary of the Capitol Hill insurrection. I mean, they're making it sound like it was something straight out of the civil rights era, you know, like the Tulsa thing that they commemorated from 100 years ago.
No.
Never forget. Never forget where you were. I mean, worse than 9/11 to these people. January 6th. I mean, I did talk about it yesterday, that Claire McCaskill is, commemorating it every 4th of July. She and her family are going to gather around. Former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill going to gather around the television, and they're going to watch a documentary on January 6th. They are so desperate to make this a thing. And, you know, something really profound struck me yesterday. And I didn't think of it until too late. This Democrat Party that now is trying to convince you and me that our opposition to them is insurrection and violence and domestic terrorism, because let's be honest, that's what they're doing. That's the narrative they've always been trying to sow with this thing. If you oppose them, you're an insurrectionist. If you oppose them, you're some sort of rebel who wants to tear down the halls of government. You want to destroy democracy as we know it. Opposition to big government Democrats is insurrection, don't you see? Wild-eyed Yosemite Sam Trump supporting. And it occurred to me, Democrats were just fine with terrorism back in 2008. Domestic terrorism as a means to an end, as a matter of fact. What do I mean by that? Do you remember who Barack Obama's chief fundraisers and pals were when he was but a state senator in Illinois and became a senator in Illinois, a United States senator, and then ultimately ran for the presidency? It was a huge issue in 2007 and 8. a huge issue to me. It was a huge issue to any American. Do you remember? Maybe you don't. And for those of you who didn't pay attention or newer to politics or too young to know, let me refresh your memory. Barack Obama's pals back in his state run there in Illinois, and then ultimately his statewide run, I should say. He ran as state senator and then a United States senator and won both. Some of his chief fundraisers were old guard domestic terrorists who literally blew up police stations and killed people. Look up the name Bill Ayers. Look up Weather Underground. Look up Bernadine Dorn. Look up the names of these people that Barack Obama, former president of the United States, called friends, chief fundraisers. He had fundraisers in these people's home. They were convicted domestic terrorists, blowing up cops, blowing up police precincts. They did that. That was a movement in the 60s. They were proud of it. The left has always been full of insurrectionists. They have a proud history of being violent insurrectionists. How about the Democrat convention in Chicago in the 60s? Violent, wildly violent. Democrats have always been the party of violent insurrection. Celebrated, as a matter of fact. Reverend Jeremiah Wright, GD America. I mean, Barack Obama literally ushered in the era in which we find ourselves today. And I don't think he gets nearly the credit he's due. I don't think people really remember how influential and instrumental Barack Obama was in introducing the country to this new way of thinking that the American left engages in today. And they want to, again, as they always do, the American left wants to push this on to you and me. They want to make it about Trump voters. Trump's supporters are the insurrectionists. They're the violent ones. They're the extremists. You oppose government, you're a Trump supporter. You're an insurrectionist. No. It's just the opposite, actually. The preservation of our institutions, our representative republic, our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, our traditions, those things are very important. And protecting those things and preserving those things, conserving those things, conservative, conserving, conservation, conserve, keep, protect. That is at the root of why most of us, I think, wake up every day and fight and care and vote. Democrats are about tearing down, deconstructing, remaking in their image. Barack Obama literally ran on it. He stood in the living room of people who would physically blow up our institutions. And Democrats not only didn't care, they made him their nominee. And he won. With a preacher, he sat in the man's church, GD America. Chickens coming home to roost, I believe he said about 9/11. We got our comeuppance. They're insane. They hate the country, and they're happy to see violent things happen to it. And now, yesterday marked 6 anguishing months ago, our Capitol came under attack by a guy in bullhorns who took pictures at a podium. And the only death, I remind you again, directly attributable to that day, was a veteran who was unarmed and was assassinated by our government, if you'd like to frame it that way, because that's the truth. It's such a joke, and these people think it's a winning issue. They think they're winning you over. They think the American public is so disturbed about January 6th. You'll never get over it. And you'll punish every Republican for it. You can't wait to vote, they think. They think every voter out there is just waiting to exact their revenge and put down this notion that anybody that stood with January 6th be rewarded at the ballot box. They will punish everyone affiliated. Why, 76 million people that voted for Donald Trump, they've all changed their minds, and they now all see the error of their ways after that display on January 6th, and they've thought about it, and they can barely stand to vote with the GOP again. They're so ashamed. They're so ashamed of Trump and that insurrection. They so value the august body of the United States Congress and those wonderful heroes and patriots within that building. They, oh, every day they grieve, and every sixth of every month, it's a little chill goes down their spine as they think about the horrors of January 6th. Please. You have to have sympathy. You have to have feelings for Congress. And the one thing the country is still pretty much united on is our total contempt for Congress. I mean, it's a joke to watch these idiots. These, you know, and I'll throw most Republicans in, too, on this. These people are not sympathetic characters. The American public does not give a rat's ass about members of Congress. And I don't know how many times I've said that over how many years. I don't know how to break it to these egomaniacs. We're not sitting around thinking about senators and congresspeople. We're not. Our emotions don't run high with their heroism from their speechifying on the floor of the Congress. We're not impressed. We're not bowled over. We don't think of them as heroes and heroines doing the bidding of the American public. They're not. They're not seen as that. They're seen as bloated. They're seen as ineffective. They're seen as useless. The legislative branch of our government, for the most part, has been an impotent, useless body as we've watched executive and judicial just ping-pong back and forth over the last couple of presidents. It's just executive, judicial, executive, judicial, executive, judicial. It's as though, and you know, every now and again we'll get a tax cut. And otherwise, that's about all they've ever accomplished, no matter who's run it. Oh, January 6th! Oh, nobody cares about you! It's like some jerk neighbor. You know, you got a neighbor next door you don't like. I mean, you don't want to see necessarily anything bad happen to them, but you find out somebody, I don't know, drove in their front yard, you know, ran off the road and pulled into their front yard and did some wheelies and tore up their lawn. Yeah. You're not crying in your coffee about it in the morning. If the guy's a jerk and you have troubles with him, you go, oh, it's a shame what happened to Mr. Wilson's lawn. Sorry, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't have the least bit of misgivings or sentiment or emotion about January 6th. None. Zip. I don't want anybody dead. I don't support it. I wouldn't have done it. And all these kind of obligatory things that I have to say about January 6th, that I'm not deemed an encourager of insurrection. Okay, but I've said all those obligatory things. And now let me say, I don't care about January 6th. It doesn't move me even a little bit. It doesn't keep me up at night. That building exists because of you and me. The people that work in that building exist because of you and me. That is the people's building. You know, what bothers me more is to see American citizens show up on the front lawns of members of Congress. That bothers me. By the way, that's Republican or Democrat. I don't think there's any place for that. But to see citizens show up on the grounds of the Capitol building, our house, our building, our taxpayer-supported building, with people who work inside it, who are elected by us and are paid by us. Okay, some people busted in and took pictures. Spare me. I'm supposed to cry over that? Oh, I've lost sleep over January 6 months. Shut up, you. Busy day today. Carla Sands with us at 7 o'clock. Who's Carla Sands? You may ask, Chris. Well, there's a Senate race here in Pennsylvania next year, as you know, and there's a new entrant into the race. She just announced yesterday. Her name is Carla Sands. You're going to meet her today. Paris Denard is back. Our regular check-in with the GOP's national spokesperson and director of Black Media Affairs, Joel Pollack, with us at 8:30 from Breitbart News. He's got the very latest on CRT, critical race theory, and what he says is Andrew Breitbart's attack on critical race theory appears to be working. What does he mean by that? We'll discuss it. Meanwhile, the American Federation of Teachers pledged yesterday, and we're going to get into this too. They are going to fight you tooth and nail. If you uppity parents think you're going to have a say in the way your kids are educated, oh, they have something to say about that. They're going to fight you. Bring it. Busy, busy Wednesday. We're off and running on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer. I'll tell you one thing about Carla Sands, who's announced yesterday she's running for Senate here in Pennsylvania. It's going to be a crowded field. You know what she did? She was the ambassador to Denmark for President Trump. I have no idea what that job entails. I'll ask her about it. How did she come to be the ambassador to Denmark for Donald Trump? Wouldn't you love to know? Like, how do you get picked to be the ambassador? I don't even know. If I wanted the gig, how do I apply? If you happen to see it over the weekend, I posted it on social media. If you want to read it, if you want to go back and review it, put it up on Facebook back on the 5th. The Epic Times was good enough to tell the story of, I shouldn't say they were here to tell my story, but they reached out to me after they, I really don't know why. I feel a little silly, frankly. Getting the media attention that I've gotten, I guess just because I happen to be on the radio, perhaps that's why. But when we made the decision to pull our daughter out of public school and put her in a private Christian school this fall, I don't know why, but I've been asked to conduct several interviews on the subject. In fact, I'm going on. This is weird. Joe Piscopo called me. He wants me to do his show today after this show to talk about it again. Which, you know, I'm happy to talk about it. I'm certainly no an authority, and it's not that it's new to you. By now, everybody knows what critical race theory is. I guess it's just that there aren't many people, maybe in media, who have kids that are making direct decisions as we are. Maybe there aren't that many. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, talking about why it's problematic, but there aren't a whole lot of people that I'm hearing yet, frankly, say I'm making the conscious decision to remove my child from it and put them in something new, and we're doing that. And I'm not saying that because I want a parade or a pat on the back. That was just a decision we made, and I told that story, and now people seem to be interested in hearing it, I guess.
Yeah, for next week, I actually booked you on Joy Reid's show and on Don Lemon's show as well to talk about it.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm sure they'll be thrilled. The Epic Times did a nice write-up on it, if you care to read it. And I've had a lot of email about it. Epic Times is widely read, I've learned. They have quite a reach. I'm getting email from people all over the country and around the world on it, as a matter of fact.
Three different people over the last 2 weeks have been in their houses, and they have the Epic Times sitting there, the actual paper.
I give them credit. Whatever they're doing it well. It's a great site. They do great journalism, great, great work. In fact, the guy who interviewed me that they sent on this assignment, he worked on it for like 3 weeks. It wasn't like a quick, you know, typically it wasn't like a quick blog post where somebody will call you up and they'll write a quick thing and then move on. I mean, this guy called me, he interviewed me, he put me on video. They have a little Epic Times newscast they made out of it, and then he went back to his newsroom and he wrote it up. He's, I believe, Chinese. And the reason I say I believe he is because he took specific interest in when we talked about the Chinese woman who testified down in Loudoun County, Virginia, on this matter. And she said very openly that she came from communist China. She learned what Marxism is, what this ideology is. She suffered, her family suffered at the hands of this kind of ideology. She recognizes it in critical race theory. And she shows up at her school board meeting in Loudoun County, Virginia, to warn them. And I simply told this man who was conducting the interview for the Epic Times, I said, listen, I am much more inclined to listen to the warnings of a native-born Chinese woman and the dangers of Marxism and cultural Marxism infiltrating our schools than some academic who tells me, don't sweat it, it's fine. I'm going to believe the woman who lived under Mao every time over some Ivy League academic. And I don't know, that seemed to resonate with him. Anyway, the only reason I bring it up is because this has now gotten such traction across the country. Not just my story, but I mean the issue of critical race theory. The left is taking notice. It has infiltrated schools quickly. It has spread like a cancer. It has been subversive and quite silent and under the radar for quite a while. People are just waking up to it. I have to credit people like our own local hero on this issue, Ilana Fishbein, who really was probably the tip of the spear nationally. We hosted her, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. Check my podcast for our extensive interview with her. I think I talked with her for about 40 minutes on it. She has launched a national organization, No Left Turns in Education. It has chapters now all over the country, people creating their own chapters. She spearheaded it. And parents are finally really waking up. And by the way, I would say to you, I've had emails from people that say, oh, this is too bad. This is unfortunate. I'm so glad my kids are up and out and graduated from college. Whew, glad I don't have to deal with it anymore. And I remind people, well, if you pay property taxes, yes, you do. I mean, if you pay property taxes, your money is going to your public school district where this stuff is being taught in your community. So, you know, just because your kids aren't in it anymore doesn't mean you shouldn't be concerned about it. Doesn't mean your money isn't going to support it. So this kind of out of sight, out of mind thing, I don't have kids in school anymore, I'm glad I don't have to worry about it, that ain't true. They're taking your money and they're funding it. So we all have a vested interest in stopping it. And because the American public has awakened to such a degree, you can tell that the left is starting to feel quite threatened by it because they're running around telling you it's not a big deal and we're making it up. Just like the election is not a big deal and we're making it up. Everything we ultimately uncover about these people on the American left and what they're up to, sadly, we're always a little behind the eight ball on it. We're a little late. But once we discover what they're up to, they start screaming and yelling about what crazy people we are. Don't they? We're making it up. We're making up problems at the polls. We're making up that critical race theory is a thing. Ah, it's fine. Everything's fine. They're making it up. They're crazy. Mm-hmm. They go into gaslight mode. Well, here's more evidence that we're dead right. They've been caught, and now they're mad about it. From the Washington Post yesterday on the anniversary of the insurrection. Amid critical race theory controversy, teachers' union chief vows legal action to defend teaching of honest history. The president of the nation's second largest teachers' union is taking a strong stand against a recent spate of laws that restrict public school lessons on racism, vowing legal action to protect any member who gets in trouble for teaching honest history. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, warned in a speech yesterday, ironically on the anniversary of the insurrection, that conservative lawmakers, pundits, and news sites are waging a culture campaign against critical race theory. You're damn right we are. The theory is a decades-old academic framework that asserts racism is woven into the history and thus the present of the nation, helping shape how institutions and systems function. In her remarks, Weingarten said that critical race theory is not taught in U.S. elementary, middle, and high schools. The theory is taught only in law school and college, she said. But culture warriors are labeling any discussion of race, racism, or discrimination as critical race theory as to try to make it toxic. They are bullying teachers and trying to stop us from teaching students accurate history. You know something, lady? Let me tell you something about public school teachers. The word public. Let me remind you that once again, you're paid by taxpayers. And I think you people in public education need to mind your effing place and recognize who you work for, me, and the people that pay your salary, just like members of Congress. You're entitled to jack. Your curriculum is up to us. Your curriculum and what you teach is what we allow. I don't know where you get off thinking you're some sort of tenured Ivy League professor because you teach sixth grade in a middle school. you exist. Your salary exists because a school board allows you to, because taxpayers fund you, and we vote for those school board members who fund you. Our tax dollars support you and pay you. You get no say in anything we don't allow. Got it? So here's a message for everyone in public education. You work for us. You teach what we allow taught. And it is high damn time that people like this get off their high horses and understand public educators work for the public, not the other way around. We are not subservient to you. We're not impressed by your academic degrees. We're not impressed by your teachers' union. We're not impressed with anything about you. You work for us. Glad you do. And a lot of you do fantastic work, but never forget who your boss is. The parents of the kids you teach. Not your principal, not your school board, us. I am getting very, very sick and tired of these people in Congress and these people in public education acting like they have dominion over our lives. They most certainly do not. In fact, there was a time in this country we didn't need a one of them. And I would argue sometimes we still don't need most of them. You know, we have a very, very capable American public who at one time used to either homeschool. A lot of people are going back to that or have been. And in some cases were one room school. My great grandmother. Her name was Pearl. Isn't that a great, great grandmother name? Pearl. One room schoolhouse. I have a. This is how quaint this was. My great grandmother. Pearl taught in a one-room schoolhouse in a town called Henrietta, Missouri. It was a little farm school. I still have her bell that she kept on her desk and a quilt that hangs in my living room of the 16 students in total, K through 12 in this little town, 16 students, and the date that all of the students stitched their little square into the quilt and gave it to her as a gift. That's how we used to do education. And my great-grandmother understood that those children were under her care, but she was a steward and a shepherd of those kids in the community. She answered to, she's not here to speak, but I think I would probably feel safe in saying, that it was an understood contract that my great-grandmother Pearl was, yes, in charge of teaching those kids, and yes, in charge of even disciplining those kids. Shocker. She was responsible for them for a window of time, but she answered to the community. She lived in the community. She was the town teacher. I can't imagine my great-grandmother telling the townspeople of Henrietta, Missouri, now listen here. I'm going to teach your kids whatever the hell I damn well please, and if you think it's nuts, you'll shut the hell up and like it. That's not the way education in this country works. Sorry. I don't know where these people get off today thinking they get to teach our kids whatever the hell they please and we're to just take it. But for too long, that's the way it's evolved and developed. Not anymore. The game has changed. We've wakened up. Republican-led legislatures driven by intense conservative advocacy, writes the Washington Post, and media coverage against critical race theory have sought to restrict what teachers can say about race. Why is this hard to understand? Public education is not a federal issue. It shouldn't be. In fact, if it were up to me, and this was once said by, I can't remember which candidate, and it was considered shocking and controversial, one of the first agenda items, if I were a limited government conservative running for national high office, is let's get rid of the education department as an entity. We don't need a secretary of education. We don't need an education department in Washington, D.C., period, full stop. Why? Because like policing, like your township, like everything else, everything is better local. Everything is better closer to you. And that is what public education, like law enforcement, has always been in this country. Local to the community, like my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother didn't answer to Washington, D.C. There was no even state standardized testing. back then. And that's as it should be. Communities get to determine their community standards. Communities get to determine what their school boards allow and don't allow. Communities should run their schools, much like communities should run their police departments. And Democrats are hell-bent, along with teachers' unions, to federalize all of this, much like they want to federalize the elections, they want to federalize policing, they want to federalize teachers' unions and teaching, so that you and I have no say. And to hell with them. To hell with them. They don't get to federalize the way our kids are taught. And states do get to restrict what teachers teach. State legislators, our elected representatives, get to tell teachers what they will and won't teach. And if there's a teacher that objects to that, you're in the wrong profession. If you're a public educator and you don't understand your place, I'm sorry, you need to be spoken to like this for a second, because I don't think you have been, and I think you need to hear it. So let me be the first to tell you, if you're in public education, I thank you. It's tough work. I know you're not getting rich doing it. I know there are a lot of people that do outstanding work. But lest you ever forget your place, you work for the public. You do not get to teach whatever you damn well please. It is not a free speech issue. So let me disabuse anybody of that right now, including you, Randy Weingarten, who thinks she's going to sue states for regulating what is taught in certain states' public education systems. Good luck. Not with this Supreme Court, thank God. Well, at least I hope. I guess I shouldn't say that, but at least I hope. No, I tell you what, if it's a war you people in public education want, by God, it's a war you're going to get from me. This is one I'm not. I will not lay down and tolerate, not for one second. I'll fight you every step of the way, and I'll win, and so will the parents of this country. We'll win. We'll beat your asses into submission on this. You are not taking this country down, and you are not going to run public education the way you see fit. You work for us, and that's the way it's going to go. So be prepared to be fought. Every arrogant, cocky school board member, every arrogant teacher and principal and administrator, every arrogant one of you that thinks you get to dictate the way our kids learn in this country, buckle up, because we have not yet begun to fight you. And if you want to fight, you'll get it. And there's more of us than you. I promise.
Hey, take us with you on your phone. Download our free mobile app now at 990theanswer.com.
The Pennsylvania Senate seat that Pat Toomey is vacating next year. It's getting very crowded out there on the Republican side. Those who want the seat, that is. Ostensibly taking on Lurch of the Adams family, the lieutenant governor. The perpetual college kid with the bong poster, Fetterman. He's, I believe... Conventional wisdom suggests he's going to be the Democrat nominee to take on whoever the Republican is. There's another Republican who's entered the race. You're going to meet her in just a minute. Her name is Carla Sands, and she served as President Trump's ambassador to Denmark. So that unto itself is pretty interesting. But if you don't know who Carla Sands is, you're going to meet her. Like I said, she's the latest to enter the race. I believe that makes the second woman in the race. Just if you're demographically thinking that way. Kathy Barnett is the other, I believe. I think I'm right on that. Paris Denard is on the way as well. Joel Pollack at 8:30 on this issue of critical race theory. I must tell you that it is, there's probably nothing I am more fighting mad about as an issue right now than this one. Many school districts nationwide already pursuing equity initiatives after George Floyd's death. But his death and subsequent national demonstrations against systemic racism fueled a fresh round of efforts from school officials to promote racial justice by reexamining the role of police, holding bias trainings for employees, and reconsidering the way history is taught. And I tell you, it is not just in schools. I'm sorry to say that it is very much also in our churches. And when you teach in this country, I just can't say this enough, when you start from the beginning of a conversation, you're white, you're black, you're oppressed, you're the oppressor. It is systemic and there's nothing anybody can do about it. When you start a conversation that way, that is antithetical to the American way, and it must be rejected and it must be resisted. We cannot allow this to swallow our schools and our churches. We can't allow it. It's got to be fought. And I mean, I know in some ways we're, as I said, way behind the eight ball on it. But you know what? If the NEA and these public education teachers unions, they want to fight with us, I am happy to have that fight. It's a fight I'm confident we're going to win, as a matter of fact. Anyway, 610-850-0980. Who's our winner? Out of curiosity.
It was Victoria in New Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah.
Online, no doubt, listening in New Mexico. What is that? So let's do the math. That's 3 hours. But it's like coming up on 4 a.m. there?
She said, I wake up early to listen to you.
Wow, Victoria, New Mexico. I feel like I should fly to New Mexico and deliver the shirt for getting up at that ungodly hour. That's awful. 3 a.m. or something in New Mexico. I hope she works overnight. She wakes up or she's working and listening online?
Wakes up and is listening online.
Wow, that's commitment. Also tells me there must be awful radio in New Mexico. I'm kidding.
No. Chris, you don't know this, the heritage station there.
I've been to New Mexico. Albuquerque. I went in eighth grade. I was a kid, but I went. I remember it. I remember nothing but a lot of adobe and turquoise. That's all I remember about New Mexico. And cacti.
Yeah.
But nonetheless. Well, Victoria, thanks so much for listening in New Mexico. That's quite an honor. Anyway, sit tight. We've got a big, big show coming up for you in the next hour. As I said, this Carla Sands is a very interesting figure. She was ambassador to Denmark. I don't know what being an ambassador to Denmark for a president is. I don't know how you're selected. But she is a Trump surrogate of sorts, and she's running for Senate in Pennsylvania. That's next.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. You live here. He lives here.
My husband and I listen to your show all the time, and we just love it.
Hey, your show is awesome.
Hi, good morning. Love you. Love your staff. Thank you so much. God bless y'all.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris Stegall on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
She's the latest entrant into the United States Senate race on the Republican side to fill Pat Toomey's seat. Her name is Carla Sands, former ambassador to Denmark for President Trump. She threw her hat in the ring officially yesterday, and she joins us this morning. Miss Sands, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Chris, and thank you for inviting me to talk to you and your listeners this morning. I am truly excited.
I guess the first question I have for you, for a lot of folks who maybe don't know your work or your relationship to the Commonwealth, could you talk with us a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So I grew up in Cumberland County and actually went to school at Cumberland Valley High School. I'm a proud Pennsylvania girl that grew up in a home where my dad worked in his second generation small family chiropractic practice, and my mom stayed home with us and raised me and my six brothers and sisters. And we went hiking and biking throughout our beautiful Commonwealth. So we had an all-American upbringing, focusing on faith and service and family. Our family has been in the Commonwealth since before the Revolutionary War, and my ancestors actually fought for our Pennsylvania ancestors fought in the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, and then ultimately my grandfathers fought in World War II. And I actually went to two different colleges here in Pennsylvania to get my prerequisites to be a doctor of chiropractic, and that was Indiana University of Pennsylvania and also Elizabethtown College. And I ended up practicing as our third generation in that practice in my hometown.
Wow. That's impressive. How did you come to become affiliated with President Trump and his campaign in Pennsylvania and ultimately work as an ambassador?
Right. Well, you know, I worked hard to get President Trump elected. I worked hard to raise funds and friends. We all wanted to defeat Hillary Clinton in 2016, so I believed in him. And then he believed in me, and he appointed me to his Economic Advisory Council, and then ultimately appointed me as his ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark.
I have never been. I must say I'm not all that worldly. I've been to a few European countries in my time. Never Denmark. I got to know what that assignment was like. And also, if you could just kind of give us a frame of reference. So often the American left loves to talk about other countries as being sort of this envy of the world, and that we should somehow be embarrassed of ours. I mean, how would you compare your experience there in Denmark versus the United States, and maybe a little bit about how they view us?
Well, those are really great and complicated questions. So Denmark looks to us as their number one trading partner. We became the number one trading partner while I was there. In fact, my team and I focused on three things: building bridges, increasing trade and investment, and securing the region for the United States people. And we actually increased just in 1 year our U.S. exports to Denmark by over 22%, creating jobs right here at home. But the Danes view the United States as their security partner and their trading partner, numero uno, I mean, the most important. They're also skeptical about any Republican-led administration. But when you look at the policies of, you know, historic all-time employment for all ages and races, when you look at the increase in manufacturing jobs, how we reduced regulations on small business during the Trump administration, reduced taxes and those burdens, it was extraordinary. We got our allies to pay more to NATO's defense, reducing that burden on American taxpayers. So they view us skeptically when there's a Republican administration, but ultimately they love Republican presidents if they're great. I would go into politicians' offices in Copenhagen, and sometimes they'd have shrines to Ronald Reagan or even full-size cutouts. So at the end of the day, they know who is great in leadership in the world.
Isn't it? Carla Sands is with us, by the way. She's running for Senate here in Pennsylvania, the United States Senate, the vacated Pat Toomey seat. She's on. She'll be on the Republican primary ballot. Is it Denmark that Bernie Sanders loves to reference when it comes to health care in their country versus ours? Am I right about that, or am I misremembering?
Well, he actually does reference Denmark, but Denmark is much less regulated than the United States. There's a lot less regulatory burden on small business, and they're higher in the sort of the capitalism index than we are. So it is a wrong reference. I think that really what he likes are the policies of places that are much more totalitarian than Denmark, which is open and everybody pays taxes, including their middle class and even lower middle class. It's a close to flat tax there. They do get benefits, but they all pay a heavy burden. And so most people can't afford to buy a car, for instance. Even the middle class are often on bikes. There are benefits to having low taxes, and the American people have more than many thousands more a year in disposable income, income they choose how they want to spend, than, for instance, people in Denmark.
This is so fascinating to me. I being an ambassador, I don't really know what goes into it. I don't even know how you're selected, but I've often, my frame of reference, it's a stupid one, so forgive the really, really clumsy and stupid reference.
No worries. But
the movie Julie and Julia, I don't know if you ever saw that, about Julia Child and her husband.
I watched it, sure.
Yeah, her husband was an ambassador to France, I think, or Paris or something like that. It was portrayed as a very kind of glamorous thing once upon a time. Is it tough work? Is it a high honor? I mean, for people that don't really know how a president ends up picking someone to go, I know they're not easy to come by, and the president has to physically sign off on the selection, so it's rare. I mean, it's quite a privilege, I think, isn't it?
It is a privilege, and I will tell you, we also have ambassadors who come up through the Foreign Service, and I wish I had known about that as a young girl going to school here in our Commonwealth. I probably would have looked at that as a career opportunity. We have wonderful Foreign Service officers who work with us every day at our embassies around the world. And in fact, my team and I got so much done. I'll just give you an example. The most important thing I think we got done together in our goals was securing the Arctic region. When I was getting briefed, when I was getting ready to go as ambassador, I saw how China and Russia had really moved into the Arctic region. You know, the U.S. is an Arctic country, and Russia is heavily militarized. They have offense and defense capabilities, much more than any other Arctic nation. And we hadn't had diplomatic relationship with Greenland, which is part of North America. It's the world's largest island, but it's also part of Denmark. It's the third the size of the continental U.S., if you can believe it. And for 67 years, we had had no diplomatic relationship. And so I was able to accomplish working with our great team at the embassy, the White House, the Department of State, Department of Defense, Energy, Commerce, and the Interior, to reestablish our consulate in Greenland. So we resolved also contract disputes around our most northern U.S. base that's on Greenland. And we also got funds for Greenland for development to counter China, which was really attempting to buy in and get partnerships in Greenland. And so I was actually awarded the Department of Defense's highest civilian honor, the Medal for Distinguished Public Service, for my work to secure the Arctic region. And it was a great honor for me, but also my team worked nonstop to get this done. So it was a terrific accomplishment mission-wide.
Well, congratulations on that. That's quite an honor. Carla Sands is with us, running for Senate in Pennsylvania here. You know it's a crowded primary. I know that you know that. And I guess I would ask, although I hate it, identity politics always comes into play these days. And I wonder if you see being a woman as an advantage or not an advantage, either, you know, cynically, politically, strategically, because here's what I've always been told about people like Pat Toomey when he was up for re-election before. Well, he's more palatable to suburban women than, say, Donald Trump was. And that's why he did well when maybe Donald Trump struggled. So what do you think of that, particularly in places like the Southeast where we know they weren't necessarily kind to President Trump, and they often aren't kind to Republicans? I've always been told that true conservatives have a hard time with suburban Southeastern women. So what of that whole thing?
Well, you know, I think what we need is someone that can win this seat. Does it hurt to be a woman today? Has Pennsylvania ever had a woman senator? Well, it doesn't hurt to be a woman. We haven't had a U.S. senator that's a woman. But we need someone that can win. That's what I look at as that's the acid test. And, you know, we have a couple of competitors in the race that are credible, but they both lost their last race. And I love that quote by Albert Einstein that says the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. I mean, I believe that's mostly true. And we've had failed politicians coming out again and again, and they're likely going to run against the same people they lost to the last time. I come with fresh ideas. I come with actual experience working with the Senate and Congress, the White House, the interagency, and I'll work with whoever is governor in Pennsylvania to bring jobs and opportunity to Pennsylvanians. I don't think Pennsylvanians really benefit from the incredible resources in our Commonwealth. We have energy enough to power the whole United States for 300 years. I mean, we need to enjoy the benefits of that and harvest that energy. I think we need to make sure that our farmers are doing well and they get the support and opportunity they need. And if you look at our universities, we have incredible universities here. Those university graduates who want to stay in Pennsylvania, but instead we have a brain drain. In 2019 alone, we lost $1.7 billion for this state because people voted with their feet and left. We just lost a congressional seat. So instead, Pennsylvania needs to be a beacon of opportunity for families and prosperity. We should be like Texas, not New York. And so I want to represent the people of Pennsylvania and fight for them.
Ms. Sands, I don't know you well. My understanding is you've lived in California for a while, and I'm sure that's going to come up as maybe you being an outsider, you come from the West Coast and you don't really know Pennsylvania. I mean, you've certainly described your history with it and how well you know it, but that's undoubtedly going to be a criticism, I'm guessing. How might you respond to it?
Sure. My education, my work, my marriage, and my service to our country have taken me throughout the U.S. and the world. I've worked across the country and the world, and what this Commonwealth needs is a fighter for Pennsylvania. I understand the issues. I understand the attacks on Pennsylvania straight from this Biden-Harris administration on our fracking, so our energy security, on the jobs. We've seen the very bad policies coming out of this administration at the border, you know, one after another, shutting down the Keystone Pipeline, but allowing Russia's Nord Stream 2 to go forward. The bad policies, both economically and in security, are astonishing. I will fight against those, and I'm known for results. I will get great things done for the people of Pennsylvania.
Have you moved back to Pennsylvania? Where do you call home now?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, of course I do. Of course I do. Yeah. I'm in my hometown. And while I was serving as ambassador, I was a resident of Pennsylvania. So I'm very happy to be home, be able to see my parents who are 82 years old, but probably listening to the show as it airs. And it's just a delight to be with my large and loving family.
I guess I have to ask also, do you think that this, and I don't know if you assess it correct the same way I do or not, that I'd be correct in John Fetterman likely being the Democrat nominee? He's the lieutenant governor here in Pennsylvania. Do you see him as beatable? And if so, how?
You know, I do think that the people of Pennsylvania are going to choose opportunity and freedom, someone to protect their rights, whether it's to raise their family without interference from the government, to enjoy their Second Amendment rights, to have economic growth and prosperity. We know how it's done. We watched during the previous administration seeing our economy do better than it's done in my lifetime, to see record-setting benefits to the American people, record-setting employment for all sectors. We know what works. I believe the people of Pennsylvania will choose a leader who can lead them to that freedom and prosperity and will not choose socialism / communism.
Are you concerned ultimately, Carla, about the election integrity issue here in Pennsylvania? Because this is something that I bring up with all the candidates that I've interviewed on from running in various places, not just for the Senate, but I ask this of every Republican I interview about a potential election fight, because it's inevitably going to come up. President Trump, his loss in Pennsylvania, whether it was valid or not, whether it deserves to be investigated or not, whether there should be an audit or not, election integrity. This seems to be something that Democrats are keen to exploit because they want to tie any Republican who questions 2020 to, you know, the events of January 6th, that you're some sort of wild-eyed insurrectionist. So how do you answer questions about the election of November 2020?
Well, so Pennsylvanians do want election integrity. I believe for most Pennsylvania Republicans, it's the number one issue for them. They understand without honest, fair, and free elections, we don't have a republic. And so we're focused on that. And when people say, oh, I don't trust mail-in ballots, well, we didn't make the rules. This leftist Supreme Court in Pennsylvania did. So what do we have to do? We have to win by the rules that we're playing. We didn't make the rules, but we're going to win. We have to be the best at mail-in ballots that you've ever seen. Until we can take a majority and get those rules righted, we have to win at the rules that were made. So we need to win the election and get those ballots in. There's no question. We also look at some of the other things. We need to roll back the terrible policies that have caused gas prices to go up by more than a dollar just since this Biden-Harris administration is in office. And we need to make sure that we control our border, that we have legal immigration and welcome legal immigrants, but we don't have 2 million people breaking into our country and taking our resources when they're not entitled to.
Would you support an audit of election 2020 here in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think that some of our Pennsylvania legislators actually went down and visited Arizona and saw how they did it. And I believe they're working toward it. And I believe that they want our election to be, to have integrity and be honest and fair, that one legal voter has one vote and that that vote is counted correctly. There's a lot of complications around the election. I mean, we all saw what we saw. And so what we want to make sure is that our elections are fair, that we are not operating like a third world country, right?
Yeah. I mean, dozens of states sued Pennsylvania, as you know. And Pennsylvania is the one state, I think, in the whole election mess. The Supreme Court ultimately did not take it up. And it's a darn shame, because I think if ever there were constitutional violations, they were found here. In my opinion, just one talk show host to a candidate, I think you're exactly right. I think election integrity, and I would follow closely behind, and I'll close on this, Carla Sands, COVID and the capricious and arbitrary nature in which this state has been locked down. In my opinion, were I running a campaign statewide, I would talk about election integrity and COVID. That's it. I mean, because this, we've been seized with this for a year as far as COVID, and then the election was just sort of the awful icing on top of that awful cake, you know? So that's kind of where my head is, and I think I speak for a lot of folks listening. What do you think about that?
Well, so I agree with you. Every business is essential. Every family has a right to earn a living. And the schools that were locked down and shut, same thing. It was in Denmark. Schools were open since April of 2020, and the schools operated close to normal and then normal. And I will tell you, we have to hold these people accountable. I am running to represent the people of Pennsylvania and their freedom, and that includes the freedom not to have businesses shut, and I will fight against that. A lot of it is in the state, but what I can do at the federal level, I will, to prevent schools from ever being shut again. And also that every child has school opportunity. We will work toward that in Pennsylvania. And I will also work to bring business and opportunity to Pennsylvania too, to make sure that we never shut down businesses, schools, and the ability for people to make a living. It's a terrible thing, and Pennsylvania is one of the worst. And if you're interested and would like to learn more about my campaign and joining our movement, I really encourage your listeners to visit www.carlasands.com.
And that's Sands, S-A-N-D-S, just like the old hotel and casino. CarlaSands.com. Well, listen, welcome to the race. I expect this won't be the last
time.
Thank you, Chris. I expect this won't be the last time we talk. You're always welcome back. But congratulations on the decision, and come back and see us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So that makes six candidates on the Republican side for Senate. Kathy Barnett, Sean Gale, Jeff Bartos, Sean Parnell, a guy called Everett Stern, we've not had on the show, and now Carla Sands. So we've talked to five of the six of them. You've met them all here. Who will win? Why are you shaking your head in there?
Oh, no. I have no idea.
This is Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer.
This is Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3 on AM 990 The Answer.
Or else. We edited that because it sounded less threatening, but he said it. Welcome in a little after 7:30. Middle of the week. Glad you're here. Telephone number 610-850-0990. Hey, Alan, good morning.
Morning, Chris. I was just thinking, after 10 years of Pat Toomey, it would be so nice to have a Republican in his place.
Do you like this slate? There's six of them now that want the job. Do you like them?
I do like the slate, and I do like the ambassador. I saw her announcement yesterday. But I think anybody has to be an improvement over Pat Toomey.
You'll get no argument out of me. Alan, thanks. I don't know. I'm staying out of this one. You have a sense of it in there, fascinating. Any of these guys you look at and you go, oh, she's the real deal. He's the real deal.
I honestly don't yet. I really don't.
I mean, you know what bothers me is I don't hear a passionate groundswell for any of them.
That's
if I could be completely candid. None of them seem to have that wow with the general voting public, or maybe people just aren't paying attention or care yet. I don't know.
And this is what happens with the PAGOP. They're always behind. Always. So Fetterman's already getting New York Times pieces and everything. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Well, and, you know, it's not like there are 800 of them competing for the post either. They kind of understand the order of things. There's a couple of them competing for it. And, yes, so they're going to have more time, money, and resources while this very crowded field slugs it out. Anyway, telephone number 610-850-0990. Yesterday, we told you about the two tweets over the 4th of July holiday weekend from two different members of Congress. One from Cori Bush, who is a first-term representative from Missouri. The other from Maxine Waters, who you know well, the representative of California. Cori Bush tweeted, "When they say the 4th of July is about American freedom, remember this. The freedom they're referring to is for white people. This land is stolen land, and black people still aren't free." Not to be outdone, Maxine Waters tweeted, "July 4th, and so the Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal. Equal to what? What men? Only white men? Isn't it something they wrote this in 1776 when African Americans were enslaved? They weren't thinking about us then, but we're thinking about us now." I honestly don't know. I want to believe that this does not resonate with most Americans, no matter their skin color. But I don't know. I would love to see statements like this. By the way, both Representative Waters and Bush are women of color, so you know. But I think most Americans, no matter their color, I believe they reject it. I've never seen it polled. Perhaps our friend Paris Denard, who is the director of Black Media Affairs and a national spokesperson for the GOP, he regularly joins us. We take his temperature. As Rush used to call his producer and phone screener, Bo Snerdly Paris, he called Bo black enough to criticize. You also happen to be a man of color, so we bring you in for expert commentary on the matter. Paris, good morning.
Well, to your earlier point, I think that you're right. It doesn't matter what your race is. They're flat out wrong. And I think that if you're black, white, Mexican, if you are gay, straight, if you are rich or poor, you should be offended by what Maxine Waters and Cori Bush did, because it's offensive to every American. And that's the thing that people forget. Americans are united under one flag. We are a unique country that accepts people in, as long as you're willing to work hard, come here legally, and be a part of them to achieve the American dream. And so when you look at the rich mosaic of what it means to be American, it is very diverse. And the idea that two black women who are both sitting in the highest seat of power, which is the United States Congress, can somehow act as if the government or the country doesn't work for them. At one point, talking about black people are not free, I don't know how much more free you can get by being elected to Congress as a black woman. That's pretty freeing. That means other people have invested in you and voted for you. Not to mention the fact that the country doesn't prevent you as a black woman to be in the Congress, to make decisions, to pass votes that impact the livelihoods, the trajectories of blacks, whites, rich, poor, everyone. That's pretty freeing.
Yes.
So it's shocking.
Paris, you're a smarter guy than me, so maybe you can answer this, because a rhetorical question popped in my head, particularly about the Maxine Waters tweet. She said, isn't it something they wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776 when African Americans were enslaved? I thought to myself, and I don't have an answer. I'm not looking for an answer, but I really wonder it. Like, what if the Declaration of Independence had not been written? What if we never had a revolution? What if we never broke free from the British? What would slavery look like today? What would Maxine Waters say about that today? I mean, could you imagine walking down that path? With whom would she have grievance today? Not the founders, I suppose.
Well, for all of the faults of humanity across the world, because there's only been one person on the earth that has been perfect and without fault or blame, and that was Jesus Christ. Outside of him, every human, every person has faults and has shortcomings. Our founding fathers are included.
Yes.
Our civil rights leaders are included. So we cannot look and say these people were perfect. But what I can tell you that they did that was wonderful and that was brilliant was that they had the mindset to put down on paper founding principles, founding documents that would serve as the guiding post for this new representative democracy. And had we not had the opportunity to have the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution, the Magna Carta, all the rest of those documents, we would not have been able to have the amendment process. We wouldn't have the freedoms that we have today, the guaranteed freedoms that we have today. We are the envy of the world because we have these founding documents, not just things that were just said or that could be changed by the whims of a king or a monarch or a dictator, but there are things that are emblazoned in pen, on paper, that has been inscribed, that is solidified, that shows everyone that this is what we believe. And when the founding fathers said all men are created equal, that's what they meant, endowed by their creator, God, with unalienable rights. These are things that we used. They weren't dumb. They put things in these documents to allow for emancipation, to allow for voting rights to come about, to allow for more freedoms and more opportunities to come through the legislative process. We were able to do that because of these documents. That's how you create a more perfect union. And so without them, I, too, tremble at the fact of where we could be as a nation. But thankfully, we had them with this foresight to put these things as our founding principles that allow us to have these freedoms, that allows Maxine Waters to live a prosperous life, Cori Bush to live a prosperous life, a free life, a successful life, a privileged life, a life of extreme exceptionalism because they are in the United States of America.
Paris Denard is with the GOP. He's the director of Black Media Affairs. I read in the Washington Post yesterday about critical race theory. Teachers Union, Randy Weingarten, the American Federation of Teachers Union head, said she's going to sue legislatures in certain states who would push back and outlaw critical race theory and other things. She says, we'll sue anybody who wants to push back or gets in any teacher who gets in trouble for teaching honest history. Now, the Washington Post, Paris, goes on to actually define. It's funny, CNN literally, as we speak, is having a discussion about people don't even know what critical race theory is. They don't even know how to define it. Well, I mean, the Washington Post does a pretty good job, actually. They say it simply as this. It's a theory, a decades-old academic framework that asserts racism is woven into the history and thus present of this nation, helping shape how institutions and systems function. I think that's pretty good. And you were just saying so beautifully how we have a system that course corrects even when it gets it wrong. But this theory is so subversive because it basically asserts everything was built on racism, thus is racist, thus certain folks are systemically oppressed, some are systemically oppressors, and there's no breaking free of it. It can't be corrected because it was built on this framework. It can't be undone. It's the most toxic ideology. It immediately pits everybody against one another with no means of correcting it, Paris.
Well, you're right. And as the Republican National Committee national spokesperson, I am appearing on countless radio and TV programs like this one. And I tell you, the American people are waking up to what the liberals and the radical Democrats are up to when it comes to critical race theory. The American people are not stupid. Parents are not dumb. They understand what's happening. And if you ever doubted the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to critical race theory, their commitment to the radicalization of America's children, and the redefinition, the redefining of who we are as a nation. You just look no further than the fact that Jill Biden is having an event with Randy Weingartner today at their national their Teach conference. And so they're in, when you have someone like Randy Weingartner, head of the big teachers union, making these statements and the proclamation that she's been doing, we know that their organization, that union, weighed in on CDC mandates for bringing children back to school, which never happened, even despite the facts, the science, and the data. And you hear her make these statements, and then you see the administration openly embrace her, openly support her by attending her conference and doing things with her. That should tell you where the direction of where the federal government is headed. And so we've got to think of this thing not just at a local level, but at a national level, a federal level. The Biden-Harris administration openly embraces Randy Weingartner, and he said on a campaign trail that if he were to win, he would be there would be a card-carrying member of the union in the White House, meaning the teachers' union, and he's living up to it. And so if critical race theory bothers you as a parent, bothers you as an American citizen, even if you just go through the very rudimentary definition, the very basic definition that you just read by the Washington Post, and I think that's a very simplistic view of it.
Yeah.
It's much more sinister than that.
Sure.
You should be very nervous about the course that this is taking, especially when you have the Biden-Harris administration openly supporting Randy Weingartner and her efforts.
Paris, how effective is this, honestly? I know you can't possibly, you know, no, I suppose we could look at polling data. Perhaps you have that. But, I mean, if you could just guess, when we talk specifically about Black Americans, how effective is this in connecting versus how widely is this rejected? If not embraced, is it rejected? Or is it a 50-50 split? Or, I mean, said another way, do Republicans have their work cut out for them trying to break through this kind of growing sentiment that if you're Black in this country, you're at a disadvantage and it's a systemically racist country that's been structured against you from the jump and you don't stand a shot? Is that working? Has that worked? Or is that being rejected by Black Americans in your view?
I think in my view, the Republican Party, and I think more sane Americans, have a uphill battle to counter the false narrative, because it's not just being pushed by, you know, some crazy, you know, college professors on some obscure college campus. These ideas, critical race theory and other things, are being pushed through by celebrities. The sentiments are being pushed by athletes. The sentiments are being pushed by the White House, the members of Congress, by business corporations, the woke corporations today, and the mainstream media. So they all work in concert on the same drumbeat. America is bad. America is racist. This is what they do. But they're wrong. And so what we have to do, our challenge is to highlight the success, counter it with the opportunities that people have, highlighting great examples of how you can achieve in this country by being, just because you're in America. And some of those examples will come from Republicans or of Republicans, but many of them will come from people who are not Republican. You can use it against them. Oprah Winfrey, LeBron James, you know, all of these people who are Maxine Waters and Cori Bush. You know, use it against them and highlight it and show the hypocrisy in their statements and how liberal ideologies are actually hurting. So when you want to talk about what's really holding communities of color back today, we can just talk. It's not critical race, the tenets of critical race theory. It's defunding the police. It's not supporting school choice. You know, when you want to look at things that are problems today that are hurting, there are a lot of these liberal policies keeping people from being able to go back to work by incentivizing them to stay home and having long-term employment and long-term salary. So our challenge is to counter it, but the counter is we're up against Hollywood, Washington, D.C., elite liberals, and the mainstream media. But it can be done. It's going to be done when we have these honest conversations with our family, with our friends, with our neighbors, our coworkers, and being willing to have the open conversation, because we're in the right.
Yeah.
At our core, we know how successful and how beautiful this country is and how many people have benefited from being American citizens.
It's daunting, I won't lie, but it seems to me there's a new frantic, almost desperate, hyperbolic push, and I theorize that Democrats are quite frightened at what seem to be inroads guys like Donald Trump were making with black voters. That's kind of my read on it. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of my sense of it.
No, you're absolutely right. The reason why you see this hyper-attention on critical race theory and fear-mongering and trying to be so divisive along racial lines exclusively is because President Trump was so effective when it came to engagement with minority communities. It's because the Republican National Committee under the leadership of Ronna McDaniel was and continues to be so intentional, not just in words, but in action and finances and resources, to really engage and work to earn the vote of minority communities. And the Democrats saw how effective it was in 2016. They saw how effective it was in 2020. And they said, if we don't put a stop to this, if we don't insert race into scare people and divide people, the Republicans are going to be about bringing people together and adding to, multiplying. So the Democrats have to do the direct opposite, divide and try to subtract, because they see how successful we've been and will continue to be.
Paris Denard with the GOP. Always appreciate your time, sir. You're welcome back anytime.
Thanks so much.
750. Telephone number 610-850-0990. The number 610-850-0990. Still to come, Joel Pollack, who has been writing about this quite a bit. He says Andrew Breitbart was working against critical race theory before most of us even knew it was a thing. And Media Matters took notice, too. Andrew Breitbart's attack on critical race theory appears to be working. That's what Media Matters says. So what is that all about? We'll talk with Joel, one of the smartest minds we have on this show. Part of the leadership team at Breitbart.com. He'll be with us at 8:30 on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer. Interesting piece. I was just reading this a little while ago in the, at the site Mediaite. Congratulations, liberals. You finally destroyed major college sports. It's a interesting take on now letting students get paid for their likeness while playing collegiate sports. I'll have some of that coming up for you. It's an interesting take if you have been pro the concept. We'll have it coming up on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer.
Your opinion matters. Take the poll at 990theanswer.com. Sponsored by Stillman Volvo. Four generations in Westchester. Online at stillmanvolvocars.com.
We are continuing to wind down the mass vaccination sites that did so much in the spring to rapidly vaccinate those eager to get their first shot and their second shot, for that matter, if they needed a second. Now we need to go to community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and oftentimes door to door, literally knocking on doors, to get help to the remaining people protected from the virus.
Knocking on doors, going door to door. What is it called when the government starts sending people door to door to check on your vaccine status? What do you want to call that? Rather than I, your humble host, give it a name, what might you call government entities going door to door checking on your vaccine status? I'll not assign it a name. You just tell me what you make of it, huh?
I mean, this immediately rings of the SS, the Gestapo.
I don't know if you're allowed to say that. I certainly didn't say it. That's Fast Eddie. Send your hate mail to him. And I just, you know, I know it's cliched at this point. I know there's no point in even bringing this up or saying it because it never sticks, but I'm going to say it anyway. I want you to just stop and consider for a moment, just for a second. Donald Trump is standing before the American public, and he says he's dispatching government entities to come knocking on your door about anything. Just imagine the reaction.
WNTP Philadelphia. Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. Download our free mobile app at 990theanswer.com. You live here. He lives here.
Absolutely love your show.
Thank you very much for your show. It is really something to look forward to when you wake up in the morning.
You've done a terrific job. You've earned my listenership.
Thank you very, very much for your sane reasoning and conversation.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris Stegall on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
No, I know. Everybody's replacing Rush out there now. Everybody's replacing Rush. I was talking with my friend Derek Hunter last week. He was on vacation, and we had a conversation about this. In our business, replacing Rush is big business. And everybody's doing it. Everybody's, quote, replacing Rush now. There are about three dozen talk show hosts that are all now claiming they've replaced Rush. I knew it was going to happen. It's a bit like watching turkey vultures circle a carcass in the middle of the road. But whatever.
Well, Chris, I just want to make you feel a little better before you get to your point. I was, you know, going through callers for our opening billboards and such.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There were a lot of callers when you did the Rush tribute show that said you were their new Rush.
Well, that's nice. Of course I'm not. And I don't view myself that way. I wouldn't. I don't. I often said, Derek didn't believe me. He thinks it's false modesty, but I said it. If I got the call, and I mean, folks, I know this seems hard to believe, but if they called me and said, we want to put you on 600 radio stations and you do Rush's show, you take over now that Rush is gone, I would likely say no. And people say, that's ridiculous. Of course you wouldn't. You wouldn't turn that down. You wouldn't. First of all, they wouldn't pay me Rush Limbaugh money. Let's be clear about that. But second, I just don't, like, the one rule in this business that some people just can't resist because their egos are such, they can't resist sometimes thinking that they're going to take the show that was made famous by someone else and continue on in that vein with that same amount of fame and success just because the person before them built it and made it. What has so often happened, and what is so often the case, is, of course, the person that made it huge and successful and robust and well-loved, once they're gone, well, they're gone. And to be the person after the person is a disaster. You know who you want to be? The person after the person who took over for the original person. That's the sweet spot. You come in after the person who took over for the guy, then the bar has been lowered. I wouldn't want that. I really wouldn't want it. I'm fascinated at the number of people who are out there claiming the mantle. And now they'll fake it. So they get all these agents and press people to write these stories about how they're taking Rush's time slot and they're the new Rush. But then when in an interview, they'll all say, oh, well, no, I'm not. No one can replace Rush. Well, then why did you allow them to say it? Why did you allow the press releases to say it? Why did you engineer and orchestrate messaging that says it? It's just so phony. So you got about seven or eight people in this circular whizzing match pretending they're all the new Rush. Well, good luck to them all. There was only but one. The guy taught me everything that I know about this, truly. And I didn't even know the man personally. I've already talked to you about Rush. But I won't say everything I ever learned about broadcasting, certainly everything I ever learned about how to think and communicate as a conservative, I learned almost exclusively from him. As a broadcaster, I marveled at him as a talent, of course, but in terms of the way he thought and the way he framed an argument and the way he held an audience, I was captivated by it. There was simply nobody better in this business at it than him. There just simply will not be anybody in this business better than him. I wouldn't dream of even attempting it. I am so perfectly... No, people don't believe this. And I'm not saying that this was always true. There is nothing in my being that is chasing after some level of massive amounts of syndicated fame or glory or money. That is not why I do this. I love very, very much being your local morning host. I always have. I've always enjoyed it. I've always understood the intimacy and the meaning and the importance in morning radio. That is something Rush did not, by the way. I mean, if I could delineate myself a little bit from Rush, Rush didn't do mornings. Rush's preferred time of day was the middle of the day. This is a very, very... If you want me to pat myself on the back for a minute, here, I'll say this. This time of day is a uniquely challenging time of day to do radio. And I've always loved it the most. I've always seen it the most challenging. It's not easy. And I think anybody in this business will tell you it's one of the harder times of day to do it. I'm not whining. I'm not complaining. I love it. I love the challenge of it. But it is uniquely difficult. And it's where I've always targeted and focused my interests, and it's always what I've loved. So really, the idea of doing any other time of day never appealed to me. Mornings is always where it's been for me because I've always seen it to be the most intimate time of the day for me personally. Now, some people disagree, and they view other times of the day, middle of the day, afternoon drive is a better time of day. I've always preferred working in the morning and talking to people first thing in the morning. And I have always been perfectly happy staying here. So even the idea of moving noon to 3, if I could have, never seemed to be as appealing to me personally as mornings.
No, that's how you know Rush was the best. Who the hell else could have filled the midday slot and had that kind of listenership?
No, it was that was like, in terms of this format, that was considered tumbleweed land before he came along 30 years ago. I mean, morning and afternoon drive were always a thing, but midday, middle of the day on talk radio, nothing. No man's land. He built it. I wouldn't even dream. I don't even know. I'm trying to think of something analogous, and I can't. I can't even. I don't want it. Like, I look at it as a shrine, like a museum, and I say, that was that magnificent piece of artwork. It would be like trying to, I don't know, repurpose or repaint the... Oh, yeah, sure, I can do it as good as Picasso. Let me at it. Give me some brushes. And it's all subjective, I suppose. That's the other thing about this business. It's subjective. Some people will listen to this show, and they can't stand me. I recognize that. I don't know why you like that guy. I can't stand his voice, or I can't stand his humor, or he laughs too much, or he doesn't laugh enough, or he's too serious, or he's too silly. It's subjective. It's all subjective. I mean, ultimately... Your ratings and revenue are the dictator as to whether or not it works, but no two people will ever agree on what makes a talented talk show host or an entertaining talk show host. It's all subjective anyway. But Rush carved out a niche where, you know, he was such a trailblazer, there was no debate about it. He was first in, he was excellent at what he did, and everybody else, you know, you follow. You're pikers, you're in the shadow. So to be held to that standard, and I'd say... You know, it's Ray Kroc and McDonald's, and then, okay, sure, I'm Burger King. Or, okay, I'm Wendy's, fine. Doesn't mean I don't have a nice burger, but you're not McDonald's. You know? So quit telling everybody you're McDonald's, for heaven's sakes. We all know there's one Golden Arches. All right. That's enough of that. Sorry. I read something just before the... top of the hour news that torqued me. If I read one more headline that says so-and-so replacing Rush Limbaugh, no, they're not. No one is. I'm very sensitive to that word replacing. No, you're not. You're taking a time slot because the man died, but you're not stepping in like people have anointed you the new great talent of the universe. All right, 610-850-0990, the number, 610-850-0990. The Delta variant. This is very interesting. Door to door.
administration will continue its effort to work with governors, local leaders, and across the public and private sector to get more Americans vaccinated by making vaccines available in more healthcare settings and respond to hotspots. The president will outline five areas his team is focused on to get more Americans vaccinated. One, targeted community-by-community door-to-door outreach to get remaining Americans vaccinated by ensuring they have the information they need on how both safe and accessible the vaccine is.
I'm trying to imagine my reaction if at Stateless de Gaulle Manor at some point in the next few weeks. Hello, we're here from the government to check on your vaccine status. I'm trying to imagine that and then my reaction. Yours? 610-850-0990. I would love to hear, sincerely, I'd love to hear. I'm not even looking for a particular answer. I would just love to hear. Hello, we're here from the whatever. We're here to check on your vaccine status. Or how about this? We understand that some in your household have still not been vaccinated. What's your reaction to that? I don't even know what that means exactly. I don't know how they do it. I'm not sure who pulls it off. But I really would love to hear if somebody knocked on your front door this afternoon or this evening. Hello, we're here from the government. We're checking on your vaccine status. What would your action be there? What would your answer be? What would you say in response to that? 610-850-0990. Sincerely, I would love to hear your thoughts on this.
We are continuing to wind down the mass vaccination sites that did so much in the spring to rapidly vaccinate those eager to get their first shot and their second shot, for that matter, if they needed a second. Now we need to go to community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and oft times door to door, literally knocking on doors to get help to the remaining people protected from the virus.
Because, you know, that Delta variant's here, folks, and the Delta variant, why, we can't lay down, not for a second. You know, they're starting to see spikes in cases.
COVID.
Cases. We're back to cases again. We're seeing an uptick in cases. Delta variant. Hello, we're here from the government checking on the household vaccine status. What would your reaction be if you got a knock on your door? 610-850-0990. I'm just curious about it. Steve's in Warminster to get us started. Steve, what would your reaction be to that?
Chris, I'd say, get the hell out of here, you vaccinazis.
Get the hell out, vaccinazi. 610-850-0990. Hello, we're here from the government checking headcount. How many of you are vaccinated? Doesn't it feel like the Sound of Music a little bit to you? Isn't there a little something Sound of Music about? Like, should the kids come down and sing So Long Farewell? Will there be a music festival we need to escape? Like, hello? We're here to check on your vaccine status. How many are in the house? Have you all been vaccinated? Why not, Mr. Stegall? I don't know. I'm not sure how I would process it if it actually happened. I don't even know if they mean it. I'm not sure if they mean it or this is just to get you and I talking about it. Maybe to even intimidate some of you into thinking, oh, I'd better. The government's going to come check up on me. 610-850-0990. Let's try, I just hung up on people. Sorry. Mike, glad you called.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Love the show. Listen, I would just ask if Biden signed an executive order barring the HIPAA violations that they're breaking the law.
That is an interesting point. I've heard that brought up before, and I don't know the answer to it exactly, the notion of the HIPAA violation. Somebody has told me before that they think it is. Others have kind of suggested it's not. I don't know, but it is. Privacy, people's health privacy has always been a big thing, right? Particularly with you ladies. I've always been told that it's your body, it's your choice, and we should butt out, and how dare we talk about you and your health care decisions? That's between you and your doctor. Hello, I'm here from the government, here to check on vaccine status of everyone in the household. Is every man, woman, and child accounted for and vaccinated in this house? May I see a head count of everyone, please? 610-850-0990. Let's try, I'm not sure who this is. You're on the air, though. Hi. Have I got you? Hello? Victoria, who is this on four?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Hi, you there? You're on the air. I can hear you, but you can't hear me. All right. Tell you what, let me take a break and get some more calls here. 610-850-0990. 816 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Chris DeGaulle now. Mike Gallagher at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
By the way, Mrs. DeGaulle has texted this morning. She said, not only would I not answer anybody knocking on our door, I think I would tell them off. It's none of the government's business, our vaccination status. It's a hard no from me. Well, I didn't have any doubt about it. My wife is one person I haven't any doubt she would be very, very blunt with who's ever at the door. I don't know. I wondered. This was something they said twice yesterday.
We are continuing to wind down the mass vaccination sites that did so much in the spring to rapidly vaccinate those eager to get their first shot and their second shot, for that matter, if they needed a second. Now we need to go to community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and oftentimes door to door, literally knocking on doors, to get help to the remaining people protected from the virus.
Layton on Twitter picked up on secret police Captain Biden on his vaccine program. Oft times door to door. Oft. I shall need my 18th century word compendium. that's pretty good. Karen says, by the way, Chris, I think the person following the guy is called a Deborah Norville in our family. I won't want to be the Deborah Norville for Rush. That's pretty... 610-850-0990. Hey, in Jenkintown, it's Norm. Glad you called, Norm. What's on your mind today?
Good morning, Chris. Yeah, if I was picking Rush's replacement, to me, the only guy would be Bo Snurley, Mr. Golden. I mean, to me, he would be the perfect replacement for him.
Yeah, he's doing his own radio show now these days. He's a great, great guy.
So. Oh, he is? Yeah. I didn't, well.
And he's hosting his own podcast out there in memory of Rush. So, yep. Yeah, no, it's nobody can really obviously fill the shoes, but he is fantastic, Norm. Thanks for the call. 610-850-0990. Greg is up next. Greg, glad you called. Philadelphia's AIM 990, The Answer. Hi.
Good morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
Pretty good. I could see them coming door-to-door under the guise of the Census Bureau. That would be a good way. And slightly tell them I've already sent my census information in. Yes, I'm a registered voter. Don't plan on changing my voting affiliation and as well as my vaccination status. That's kind of some information that's to be kept between me and my family doctor. If you want to access it, then you can submit the forms to my primary care physician to get the forms from him.
May I ask you something? And you just said it, so you kind of said something similar. So I wasn't going to bring it up until somebody else did. You said you thought that they could use the sort of the guise of a census-style survey to come knocking. Let me ask you, do you think this could be, just for fun, could it be a door-to-door political turnout-to-vote dry run?
Well, I believe it could also be that, too. I mean, like I said... with them to stop and say, hey, are you a registered voter? Yes or no? Well, here you go. We'd like to have you fill this out and, you know.
No, that's it. Greg, I thank you for the call. We don't do this in this country is the point. We don't go door knocking. Government officials do not knock door to door compelling you to act on anything. This is much like Obamacare compelling you to buy insurance. The government is not to compel you to do anything or participate in anything or buy anything. Hello, I'm from the government. I'm here to ask about your vaccine status. How many members of the household? Have all of you been vaccinated? I just wonder your reaction to that. 610-850-0990 in Delaware. It's Gwen. Glad you called, Gwen. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I would not, first of all, I never answer my door unless somebody texts me or calls me ahead of time. Second of all, they have to come up two flights of steps. Third, I don't believe in them, not, you know, coming asking me questions like that. And fourth, I was just looking online to get one of those detectors that if somebody comes near your door, a vicious dog barks.
I like it. Get Steve Moore's dog. They won't come knocking at Steve Moore's house. We know that. Our chief economist, he's got a vicious attack dog. He releases it every Tuesday at 8:30 when we speak. Thank you, Gwen. 610-850-0990 to King of Prussia. It's Cecilia. Hiya, Cecilia.
Hey, thanks, Chris, for taking my call.
You bet. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I would love for them to shut off at my door. Because I would please let them come. I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse for 30 years. Who the hell are they to tell me about making a decision about vaccines for me and my family? I'd had some raw eggs, and I'd plummet them with
them. Out of curiosity, if they asked, and you felt compelled to share it, have you been vaccinated? I'm just curious. I'm not looking for an answer one way or the other.
Yeah, no. Actually, I have, because of the environment I work in. High risk.
How about the rest of your family?
None of my children, and they're grown adults, from 21 to 29.
All right. Well, I'll be noting this for a future survey.
Right.
Thank you, Cecilia. 610-850-0990 in Mount Laurel. It's Jerry. What do you say, Jerry? Hi.
Good morning, Chris. Love your show, pal.
Thank you, buddy.
I'm kind of concerned. I wonder if this is about the vaccine at all. I think they might be doing some recon and just an excuse to sniff around neighborhoods, get a lay of the land, see where you live, what neighborhoods look like, and just kind of picture what these geniuses are going to look like walking through your neighborhood. Because given this bunch, who knows what's going on, but I don't know that it's all about that straight up.
To what end, out of curiosity, do you think they would just be checking around, nosing around?
Just to see, like, what neighborhoods are like, if there's redistricting in the future, anything of interest that could be of, resegmenting neighborhoods and things like that. So just a thought, but it occurred to me when you said that, I thought, you never know. So,
you know, Jerry, you say something that makes me consider. Yesterday was a very emotional day for members of the media. It was the 6-month anniversary of the insurrection. Did you see all that yesterday? We talked about it earlier in the show. All the members of the media commemorating the frightening day 6 months ago to the day, the insurrection. Like, I guess stories like this. Representative Andy Kim walking around the United States Capitol with a trash bag on January 6th in hand, trying to clean up after insurrectionists ransacked the building just hours earlier. And now the New Jersey Democrat, Congressman Andy Kim, he'd come across a plaque commemorating the cornerstone of the Capitol laid by George Washington. It was a very profound moment, he told CNN. It hit me in that moment, the magnitude of what had happened. It occurred to me that this was actually probably the worst condition that Capitol Rotunda had been in for years. And so now, 6 months after the attack, Congressman Kim announced he would be donating the suit he wore in the now infamous moment he was captured cleaning up the damage done to the Capitol to the Smithsonian. As they build an exhibit at the Smithsonian documenting what happened on January 6th. Yes, hanging there in the Smithsonian with an Elvis jumpsuit and Archie Bunker's couch will be Congressman from New Jersey Andy Kim's suit. But, you know, as he called and said, he felt uneasy about it and doesn't really know what they're up to and doesn't think it's about the vaccine at all. It occurs to me, is it possible that these people are just constantly poking you and me? Is it possible that they know damn good and well they can't and won't do it, but really what they're doing is just constantly making you think they might? Keeping you on edge. And then, you know what it is? It's like, again, it's that poking you in the chest, shoving you in the chest. I dare you. I dare you. I dare you, insurrectionist. I dare you. Is it possible? Is it possible these people know you and me in the way we can't stand them and we don't trust them? And so they say things that they hope will create yet another January 6th style insurrection. Is it possible you and I are being goaded and baited by these people? Is that possible? Just asking.
It's Mike Gallagher. Join me this morning at 9 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now let's get you back to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with the great Chris DeGaulle.
So glad to welcome back to the show Joel Pollack. Joel is Breitbart's senior editor-at-large, and there's a piece from a few days ago now, headline Media Matters, Andrew Breitbart's attack on critical race theory appears to be working. Joel, first of all, welcome back. This subject of critical race theory, I know you have covered and covered well, but it's interesting that Andrew, as usual, seems to have always been very, very prescient and well ahead of the curve, sort of the tip of the spear on this stuff. Welcome back in.
Thank you very much. Yes, Andrew was way ahead of his time in anticipating a lot of what's happening right now.
And when they say it's his attack on critical race theory that's working, what do they mean by that? How is it his? I'll confess, I've had kids now. I've got a 16-year-old who will be a junior going into his junior year of high school, one going into a sophomore year, and my daughter who will be entering her seventh grade year. And really, this last calendar year, in the midst of COVID, is the first meaningful time I can remember having a discussion about this being taught in public school classrooms. And now it's everywhere. It's in my church, for instance. I've left my church over it. I mean, it seems like it just exploded on the scene, although I know it's been around much longer than that.
Well, the reason Andrew was able to anticipate this was because of his research into Barack Obama. Barack Obama, president at the time, was steeped in critical race theory and had been exposed to it as a student at the Harvard Law School. And one of the pioneers of critical race theory was a professor there named Derrick Bell. And shortly before he died, Andrew had been working on a story connecting Obama to Derrick Bell. And this was going to be a very important part of vetting the president because he was never properly vetted by the media in 2008. Unfortunately, of course, Andrew passed away, but we did the story he'd been working on, and we went deeply into Derrick Bell's views and how they affected Obama and others on the left. And at the time, the media tried to dismiss it, much as they're trying to dismiss it now. They said, well, what's wrong with critical race theory? It's just about the intersection of law and race and class, a bunch of meaningless words, basically, they would throw at it. But it is very serious indeed, and critical race theory teaches that all of our institutions are inherently racist because the country was founded at a racist time when black people could be owned as slaves, and therefore even with the civil rights movement, even with equality before the law, we don't have racial equality, not just because there are economic gaps, but because our very system of law, this is the argument, our very system of law is based on the inferiority of black people and the supremacy of white people. So we need revolutionary change to that system to correct that fundamental inequity. And that is the governing philosophy now of the Biden administration. And people are starting to notice it in their schools because of the radical curriculum that has been introduced. It's been introduced over the last several years, but it really sharpened last year after the George Floyd riots, the protest, if you will. So parents are waking up and discovering that their kids are being taught to dislike the country. Or if they're not being taught to dislike the country, they're being taught about the country's flaws without being taught the history first. They're just told what's wrong with America before they're told the actual history. So people are alarmed by this, and they're starting to notice it at work with forced racial sensitivity training. It's starting to come out of government departments, military academies. This has gone everywhere in the last 10 years or so, and it was emboldened, I think, by Obama and by his education policies. And ironically, people who believe in this stuff don't care that Obama was the country's first black president. These signs of progress are twisted into signs of the underlying systemic racism. They'll come up with some sort of reason why Obama's election really reflects the fundamentally racist nature of the country. So, for example, if a white person is proud of having voted for Obama, that shows that there's systemic racism. That's the kind of, it's the sort of ideological torture that's being imposed on Americans, but especially on children. And people are starting to stand up against it. But Andrew saw it coming because he understood how these left-wing ideologues worked. He had written about it in his memoir, Righteous Indignation, about critical theory and about the Frankfurt School. And he was about to explore this new area, critical race theory, which developed in the 70s and 80s, really. And then, you know, we carried the torch after he passed away, but the media tried to suppress it then. They said, oh, there's nothing to see here. This is unimportant. But now people realize just how important it is.
Yeah, it's one of these kind of, the term gaslighting doesn't get it done, but, excuse me, it's the closest thing I can think to gaslighting. It's this kind of heads I win, tails you lose presentation. No matter what you say, no matter how you apologize, no matter how you atone or what you do, there's no way out of it if you are, in fact, part of the oppressor class. True? That's sort of the thing. There's no fixing it.
There's no fixing it, right. And Derrick Bell said the civil rights movement was a problem because it created an illusion of equality.
Yeah.
Whereas property itself was the problem. His proposed solution was that we would adopt a series of socioeconomic rights that would redistribute wealth and redefine the nature of property. Only then, he believed, could the damage of our founding be done. And that's become the party, the policy of the Democratic Party as well. I mean, they want to create all kinds of rights to everything, right to health care, right to housing. They want to create all these socioeconomic rights that exist in some other constitutions in other parts of the world. There's a right to housing in South Africa, for example, but the irony is that when the government gives you a right to housing, they don't give you housing. You just have a right to housing. It becomes an excuse for the government not to give you what they've promised you. And really, the governments can't provide that sort of thing. There are a lot of things that people provide best for themselves. Now, healthcare, obviously, you can't provide for yourself. You're not going to perform surgery on yourself or whatever. But the idea is that people should have these public services. They should be provided. They're often better provided by private charity. And once you make them a right, you, in a sense, bind people to government in a way that takes away initiative, takes away innovation. No one's saying everyone shouldn't have health care, but often when these things are considered moral imperatives for society to provide on its own, they tend to happen better and more efficiently and effectively than if you say, oh, well, it's the government's issue. So that's what the left wants. They want rights to everything, food, housing, a clean environment. They want to enshrine that all as rights. And they know they are changing the nature of property. They're changing the nature of our entire system by doing that. And that's the goal. And critical race theory says that's what's necessary to redeem America.
You know what troubles me about it most, Joel, is I fear that this creates, this will stir, it will engender this smoldering resentment in whites over time. I don't know how long, that eventually bubbles over and becomes ugly. I don't know how else to say
it. Well, I don't know about that. You know what? I don't think that happens quite that way. I mean, certainly there's some ugly incidents that have happened, but I don't know that you need a particular trigger all the time. What I do think happens is that white people and other minorities, Asians, Hispanics to some extent, what you see is people just start withdrawing from public life. They say, okay, you think I'm a racist? I don't want to be involved. I'm just going to do my own thing. I don't need this. I don't need to be told how terrible I am. I don't need to be told that I'm a bad person even after I'm volunteering in a community to make things better or donating money to a charity. You know what? I'm just not going to be involved. And you're starting to see that. This outrage about critical race theory, where people are coming to school board meetings, that's a very positive sign. It shows people haven't given up yet.
Yes.
But I'm already seeing places where people say, you know what? I'm just not going to get involved in my community. I'm not going to get involved in my university. I'm not going to help out at the company picnic. People think that, you know, I owe them something. I'm just going to do my own thing. I don't want to be bothered. And that's a danger to our system of government, because once people start withdrawing into their own individual world, they don't become involved in public affairs. We have worse government. We have worse public affairs. This is a problem that Alexis de Tocqueville warned about in Democracy in America, his great book, 200 years ago. And but that's what's happening. I mean, you know, and you can't blame people. The irony is, by the way, whenever you have affirmative action policies around the world that create this new idea of race or particular classes of people, particular groups of people are entitled to something, the people who are being disadvantaged, that is to say the people who are supposedly privileged, they end up doing even better because they withdraw from public life and they go into the private sector.
Yes.
They withdraw from companies and they start their own businesses. So it doesn't actually address the inequality. It just boots people out of things that are under the control of that policy, and it encourages people in the minority groups who are, or not necessarily minority groups, it encourages people who are supposedly privileged to do their own thing. And that doesn't help the people who are supposed to benefit from these policies. So what we have in critical race theory is a division and weakening of American society, and that's why people of all races are actually going to have a problem with it.
Yeah, that's what I don't mean. I guess I don't, if it sounded as though I was implying something violent or something, I don't mean that. I mean, when I say resentment, I do mean that withdrawal. I mean that you create your own, people will just do out of necessity. All right, well, if I'm not welcome here, or I'm going to be treated hostily here, then I'm going to go over here and I'll start my own way. And it sort of leads to its own kind of segregation again. It's reverse. It goes in reverse of the progress we've made, does it not? It seems to me it's where it would go. People would just kind of colonize, segregate. Fine, I'll just go over here where I'm welcome, or create my new existence over here.
Yeah, and it's very damaging, and this is why people are pushing back against it, and rightly so. And you're seeing the media trying to suppress that criticism, but people should be encouraged. They should keep doing it, keep pushing back, because critical race theory is not just about races and discrimination and inequality. It is an attack on the country's founding principles, not just the founders, but the principles of the founding. Our UN ambassador under Biden, Linda Thomas Greenfield, said in a speech recently that our country's principles are run through with white supremacy. There's nothing about our country's principles that have anything to do with white supremacy. In fact, if you don't believe me, ask Frederick Douglass, ask Martin Luther King Jr. They all said that while the country was flawed, the principles in the Declaration of Independence would redeem the country. So we have a radical philosophy that has made its way to the top levels of government, onto the world stage. The people who are supposed to represent America are running America down in this way. It's got to stop.
Yeah.
And the good thing is that there are a lot of like-minded people out there who are standing up, so people should not be discouraged. Don't be discouraged if people call you racist or whatever. What they need to explain is why they hate America, because fundamentally that's what critical race theory is about. I saw Congresswoman Cori Bush tweeting about it, how 4th of July was not a day of freedom and so forth. Okay, then resign. Let someone who loves America represent the people of your district. I'm sure you can find many. But this is something I think, this is a fight we're going to win, because the other side is wrong. The Biden administration is wrong. They're just wrong, and they're wrong in a very basic way. And this is a fight we're going to win. So yes, people ought to be very concerned about it, but just keep in mind, this is a fight we are winning. That's why the left is scrambling.
Yes, I agree. And I do wonder, I asked Paris Denard this earlier, Joel, with the GOP. I said, I don't know if it's been polled or how you can test it exactly. I don't know if it works with black Americans, if black Americans are sold. I'm also interested that it's driven by, Joel, so many white supposed intellectuals, the Randy Weingartens of the world who run the American Federation of Teachers. This kind of elitist white push of this theory is interesting to me, particularly in education.
Well, the reason elite white people like these theories is that these radical theories say that the real problem is white privilege and white supremacy. That means the people who are most important to solve the problem are white people. That white people who renounce their privilege have a kind of importance in this left-wing resistance. And so, ironically, it attracts elite white people because they have found a way to be useful, relevant, and crucial to this new movement. You'd think that they would engage in some kind of self-sacrifice, that they would, if they really believe this, you know, that inequality was the big problem, they would step aside and so forth. But actually, these ideologies, like critical race theory and systemic racism, give elite white people a way. Not all, by the way, but just those who subscribe to this theory. Some of them do so because it allows them to retain, ironically, the kind of privilege and the kind of importance that they wouldn't have otherwise if they were true to the idea of equality. But because they're invested in this idea of white supremacy. Only they can undo it. So that's why you have these, you know, privileged kids rioting in the street against white privilege, because it makes them important in a way that ordinary attempts to solve problems like this just don't. And they feel empowered by it. They feel that they're suddenly important. And they feel they're important relative to other white people whom they want to attack.
Joel Pollack, I can't thank you enough for this. I guess I should also kind of, to a degree, we've got to thank Andrew for really setting the ball in motion years and years ago. We're just now starting to only kind of pick up on it. At least I am, I will say, in the last year. With my own kids. I mean, we're making the decision to extract my daughter. This is what I mean. I'm extracting my daughter from school over this and putting her in a private Christian school, something that we wouldn't have even thought of doing even just a few years ago in our public school system. And I don't think that's necessarily a positive thing. I mean, people may disagree, but we were perfectly happy with our school system, and now we're not, and this is why. And so, you know, is my school better because I'm withdrawing my kids? I don't know. I mean, whatever. That's for another debate. But Joel, thank you. Breitbart News Senior Editor at Large. So appreciate your time as always, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your opinion matters. Take the poll at 990theanswer.com. Sponsored by Stillman Volvo. Four generations in Westchester. Online at stillmanvolvocars.com.
News. Opinion. Passion. Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer.
This, ladies and gentlemen, some honesty broke through. This come from ESPN, this Steven Jackson clip, Fast Eddie?
Just his Instagram account.
Oh, he was on Instagram talking about this.
Yep.
Now, he played, I'm not an NBA guy, so forgive me. He played where? Or do you know? You don't know either? That's all right. If you don't know and you follow it, then I'm okay. He's a former NBA player, Steven Jackson, and he was on his Instagram account talking about Rachel Nichols. The white lady who has just been, by the way, benched, suspended by ESPN. They suspended her, gang, for saying in a private call that was leaked, that was taped and leaked, that she didn't want a black colleague of hers being promoted to the to a plum NBA role on the network just simply because the network has a reprehensible relationship with racial issues. They didn't want, she said, I don't want my career, everything that I've worked for, to suffer just because I think her name's Maria, my colleague, is black. How about a moment of honesty here?
Think about this though, bro. How many times we as black people have said that we was qualified? We know we qualified. We know we qualified for the job, but we didn't get it because they gave it to the white person just because he was white. How mad were we? Because they looking out for their own. How mad were we? When you know you deserve the job and they give it to a white person just because he white. We've been dealing with that our whole life. And that pisses us off. We ain't getting recorded, but we say too behind closed doors. So I get it. I get it why Rachel mad. Rachel ain't never showed me no signs of being racist. But I would be mad too if I worked my whole life for a job and they gonna give it to a white dude just because Donald Trump in office. Or just because a white kid got killed, and at the time it'll look better for a white person to have a job. I would be mad too.
Harumph, harumph, harumph.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Give the governor harumph.
Harumph. You watch your ass.
Steven Jackson basically saying giving away a job because just George Floyd is wrong.
This is
see you tomorrow.
WNPP,
good for him.
Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer. A Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.